This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The power structure stands to be shuffled at the Honolulu City Council as Councilmember-elect Tommy Waters is expected to take over for Trevor Ozawa next month once special election results are certified. Ozawa had been in line for the council chairmanship, so it's anyone's guess right now who'll take over that slot. We sat down with Councilmember Kimberly Pine yesterday afternoon to talk about homeless solutions. She told us she's not eyeing the chair slot, but is interested in the mayor's office, which will open up in a year and a half. Pine has proposed that each council district be allotted $2 million to help with the homeless solutions in their area, as she doesn't believe it's one size fits all.
I've been working on the homeless issue for over a decade. I decided as a state legislator to actually get a job at a homeless shelter, U.S. Vets and Kailua, so I could truly understand this population. And so I have been pushing different housing initiatives for a very long time, mental health initiatives, as well as drug addiction initiatives for a very long time. And it's just really time that we think out of the box and find one location where we can move the homeless to, and the state now is calling it a kahale zone. And that idea came from my own community, Twinkle Borge and the Waianae Boat Harbor residents, where they have been watching how the city and the state have handled this issue. The city implemented the sit-lai bills, and as I stated many years ago then, because it's not island-wide, people are just going to be moving from one street to the other. And you can't really move someone out of a place unless you have some place to put them. And so I've been arguing for a very long time that that's important. But more importantly, we are finding that there are certain homeless populations that don't do well in a certain shelter setting. Not that they don't think it's fancy enough for them. It's just that either because their drug addiction issues, their mental health issue, there's certain anxieties that go along in that scenario. And so we are proposing for this kahale zones, basically, where it would be what we consider the city council, a safe zone, no more tent cities, but really a small structured, affordably built housing where communities can be formed or we move entire communities that are already formed. And examples of that is in Waimanalo as well as Waianae, where we help them to purchase the land. We help them to keep their community structure that they have now or improve it, and also allow to have hygiene centers on the spot there, mental health providers, drug addiction providers, and other social workers all in one location. The police are also introducing what they call lift zones, where they choose certain city land, possibly parks that aren't close to homes, where they can triage people into one place. So if they move them from downtown, for example, and they find another location to move everyone to, where they also have those similar services, and that's the police's proposal, but there's no money in the budget for that. So really what this proposal does, it allows every district to come up with their own idea, or possibly we might make some amendments in the budget, and we discussed that yesterday in full council, where area council members can join up together to find a solution. See, every community is different, and so this allows that flexibility.
So wouldn't there be like a problem potentially with coordination with some of the outreach organizations and nonprofits that are servicing, you know, the clientele?
There's always a problem, but there's never been a true will to have a comprehensive homeless plan, and that was in an audit, a city audit that said that the city has no comprehensive plan for homelessness. And so in my committee next week, we are going to be posting a discussion item, saying, okay, so the auditor said this, what are we not doing? What can we do? The homeless providers are very excited to help in any way they can. They just need strong leadership at the very top to say, okay, we are going to give as much city resources as we need to make sure that you're successful. What we've been doing now is just kind of piecemeal things and not really putting everything all into one particular location, well, several locations throughout the island.
So as far as the support from the administration on this, I mean, Do they like it, not like
well,
it?
Well, Contra Chair Martin introduced a similar allocation of $18 million a couple of years ago. Council members were constantly saying, look, we can figure this out. Let us help you lead in these issues. But the coordination between the council members, who are the closest to the districts and the community leaders, and the administration, there's just so much resistance from the administration for some reason. I can imagine the mayor is just as frustrated. He's on a 6-year, and nothing has really, truly improved. In fact, it's gotten worse in some parts of the island where homelessness actually increased. And really what happened, it just moved from one part of the island to another part of the island. And so I'd imagine that they are looking at their situation and will be more open to this idea. At least that's my hope.
So where's it at on the budget list right now? Because you're in the middle of the budget hearings.
Yes, so it's in our budget bill. We just passed the budget on second reading. It's going to come back to committee. I will be adding those amendments that allow more flexibility for the funding for area council members to team up to have solutions for their particular district.
Now, I know that when the mayor was in here, at that time, I believe San Diego had just passed a law to allow people to sleep in their cars. And that, I know, is something that in East Honolulu, they said they're seeing issues at Sandy Beach where people are car camping. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's up in Haleiwa at the boat harbor over there. You know, what are you seeing in your district?
Gosh, we're seeing them sleeping everywhere, especially with the sit-lai bills that occurred in Waikiki and downtown and other areas surrounding there. We had huge increases in homeless coming from the town area to the Waianae coast, especially. At One'ele Beach Park, we had a big increase in people who were more drug addicts, mostly single men. They came from Waikiki. But in Waianae, we're really seeing everything. And what's different about it now, and that frustrates our community there, is we used to all know the homeless because there are family members that just couldn't make ends meet. You couldn't fit any more people in the house. They've used every square footage of the house. And people would always visit their family members and then eventually, you know, help them with either their addictions or they found an affordable home and they can come in. Now things are so out of control that we don't even know a lot of people. There's a lot more violence occurring as well. And the homeless never used to attack people or threaten neighbors, and now that's starting to occur.
Now, at the council meeting yesterday, I know you folks also advanced the vacation rental bills, and then you passed a third reading, the monster homes.
Mm-hmm.
What's your sense as to what's going to happen now with the administration? Because it sounded like DPP had some concerns about the way the bill was worded.
Well, they always have concerns, but what I'm trying to, as the zoning and housing chair, is to really change the entire culture of DPP. The entire culture of DPP has been very front-loaded in their plan checking, and so what has happened as a result is permits have been taking 1 to 2 years. We had people come and complain saying they had $30 million in work, small home family contractors saying they have $30 million in work and they have to lay people off because they can't get a permit. So their same concerns were saying, you know, the impervious surfaces, which basically says you have to keep at least 25% of your lot to allow the water to go through either gravel or porous concrete or grass just to save our aquifer as well as prevent chemical runoff into the ocean. And they're saying, oh, that's going to make things take longer in the plan check. And what I'm trying to do is change our culture and make everything loaded in the next step, and that is the inspection period. That's where they can find the illegal vacation rental, people who are illegally converting their home. And that is where we need to focus all of our new monies to improve DPP in that area. And so I did meet with Roy Amia, the managing director of the city, and I said, look, what DPP is most concerned of was the number one thing that the anti-monster home people felt was needed. Because what was happening in Kaimuki and parts of Manoa and Palolo is entire lots were being concreted. People noticed that it seemed to be 5 to 10 degrees hotter. More electricity use for air conditioning. They found that more water and chemicals were running into their yards and that more water was going into the drain. And so that was so important to this bill. And so I'm glad that the council passed it by 9-0.
As far as, you know, whether the mayor signs it or not.
It's very rare for a mayor to veto a 9-0 bill. The concerns that DPP have, I really believe, and Governor Abercrombie said this in the questioning period. He was with the Anti-Monster Home Group. He said, look, all of these things we can fix in rules. We don't have to start a new bill. We can fix whatever concerns DPP has.
Okay, but you feel pretty good about the passage?
Yes, it was. I have to say that was probably one of the most complicated bills I had to oversee because the first reading was such a so much conflict. You literally had people yelling at each other, people from the Building Industry Association saying, look, we're not rich here, we're just trying to do family homes. And then you had the anti-monster home people that were very emotional, yelling at the developers saying that you guys are greedy. And so we came from a place that we're very far apart and no one thought we'd ever come together. And I'm just so proud and inspired by what happened. This was a bill that was brought forth to government by the people. And it was the people that realized, hey, we all want the same thing for our kids' future. And so both sides came together in such a valiant way. And it was amazing that we had almost complete consensus in the end.
Right, because it was affecting pretty much everybody's district.
Yes.
Ikaika's, mm-hmm. Trevor's, yours.
Yes, yes. But I have to say, when this issue first came to me, I was very much against putting any regulation because I come from areas near Waipahu, Ewa Beach, Kapolei, and even Waena, where we have very large multi-generational homes. And so I thought they were targeting people who are just trying to survive. And then Councilmember Ozawa showed me what he meant by a monster home. And I went to Kaimuki, and I'll never forget, it was a 20-bedroom home that was completely concreted over 20,000 square foot area that used to be just two tiny, you know, homes. And so then I understood that there is a difference between the multi-generational home that I know of in my culture and in most of Hawaii, actually, in these monster homes.
On vacation rentals, do you think there'll be a move to hold off until Tommy Waters takes office? Any sense on where that's going?
Well, I know that everyone would like to get this done as soon as possible, but I think we need another month on this particular issue. Some council members are still very far apart. There are a few council members that want to add a little bit more TVUs into the legislation. Some council members want to make sure that these vacation rentals have their own tax class. That's been taken out of the current version. And the anti-vacation rental community doesn't want anything. They want zero. And so we still are very far apart, but it is my hope that perhaps it will be when Tommy Waters' first vote, perhaps, will be probably one of the most controversial legislation that the city has ever taken up.
And do you have a sense as to what's going to happen with the organization? Because your name has been floated out there as possible council chair, Ikaika's.
Well, I will decline. I was chair, as you know, and vice chair and zoning chair all at the same time because we couldn't sit, Trevor or anyone in that seat. And so because I was vice chair, I automatically moved up to all these positions at the same time. And I just felt that because the city was so divided that we had to come together. And that's how we came up with this current structure where Ann Kobayashi wanted a budget, Joey wanted a budget, so I said, hey, why don't you take chair? And then I stepped down from chair and vice chair and kept zoning. And it's been actually quite wonderful. And I think what everyone's a little sad about is there's an uncertainty if Tommy's added, will that change the harmony that we have now? But I personally know Tommy, and we served on judiciary together and in the House of Representatives, and he really is just lovely, I have to say. And we canoe paddled in the same team together many years ago when we were both in shape. And so I think his personality will be welcomed.
Okay, but you don't see yourself taking over as chair?
No,
of the city council?
No, I think that I would like to continue my work on the homeless issue and the affordable housing issue, and whatever committee that ends up, that would be my preference. I think we're so close to coming up with some real tangent solutions that will last for many decades to come.
And what about the mayor's post? Because the mayor is going to be leaving office. His term is almost up. Are you interested in that position?
I'm definitely interested in that position. And I will be honest, I was expecting to perhaps retire from politics for a little bit. I've been doing this for quite some time, rather unexpectedly. I was just an average citizen that was upset at government, and I ran and unexpectedly won. But I have to say, we're just talking about the mayor not releasing funds that and continuing on plans that the council worked so hard on. I'm deeply concerned that we have spent or allocated over $40 million in Ala Moana, where multimillionaires look and see when there's parks and community areas that the city owns throughout the island that they don't even have a single parks keeper. Trash isn't even being picked up on a daily basis. There's some serious inequality issues, and since I represent an area where we have a large volume of low-income residents, that's so personal to me. And so I would love, not necessarily, I don't need the title, but I would love to be in that position to just pick up the phone and help someone that's been forgotten.
That was Councilmember Kimberly Pine, who sat down to talk story with us yesterday afternoon.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Evo Hemp, offering organic fruit and nut bars in flavors such as mango macadamia, available at club stores in Kahului, Kailua Kona, and Lihue. EVOHemp.com.
I'm Ira Flato. 5G is headed your way, but what is it? On the next Science Friday, we'll explain the new mobile network, the pros and the unknowns, and why a senator and a congresswoman want to know whether the radio frequencies can cause cancer. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon from 1 to 3.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your Aloha Friday quiz.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukahoolawe, uhawaiti.
Today we're digging into the history of illicit backyard brewing. For most of the 20th century, Hawaiian moonshine, or okolehau, was produced illegally in the deep valleys and inaccessible forests for much of the 20th century. However, the drink dates back to the 1780s when Captain Nathaniel Portlock first showed Hawaiians how to make the intoxicating beverage from a particular root. About a decade later, William Stevenson, an escaped Australian convict, modified the fermenting process. He showed local islanders how to distill a mash of these fermented roots in iron pots used by whalers to boil blubber. And after perfecting this technique, okolehau consumption skyrocketed and was said to be a gift from heaven. In fact, King Kalakaua was said to have loved it so much he granted a full royal pardon to a man in prison for making illegal moonshine. For today's quiz, can you tell us which plant's roots were instrumental in brewing up this intoxicating beverage? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Chaminade University and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
It's been more than a year since a so-called rain bomb drenched Kauai, leaving behind flooding and destruction around Hanalei Town and the North Shore. Now, that community has been dealing with park and road closures ever since. But on May 1st, the road to Haena will officially open to outside traffic. The state park and its popular Kalalau Trail are expected to follow suit by early summer. In preparation, state and county authorities are developing a new system for managing vehicle and foot traffic into the state park. HPR's Ryan Finnerty spoke with Sue Kanoho from the Kauai Visitors Bureau for the latest update.
The initial shock and devastation of the actual flood took everybody by surprise. We had three areas that were affected, you know, of course, the North Shore, and then Keapana, which is in the Kapa'a area, and then in Kaloa Town. Our first message was, one, of course, to get everybody out safely, which they did an amazing job of. So we were really, really blessed that everybody made it out with no fatalities. And then it was to get the messaging out because, as you can imagine, everybody saw the images in the mainland and thought the whole island had been affected. So people started canceling vacations. And so the good news is we got on the phone right away and on the internet and to social media to get the word out that call us and let us know where you're staying and we'll tell you, you know, if that area is affected or not. And as you know, with the North Shore being cut off for so long, we've just been really honest with everybody about, you know, yes, you're staying in Poipu. Did you have plans to hike the Kalalau Trail? If you did, we just wanted to let you know it's closed. Some people, believe it or not, I will tell you the thing that we learned about this is that there's some people who actually come solely with that intent in mind is to hike Kalalau Trail. I mean, they'll do other things, but we just were not aware of how important the Kalalau Trail is to many people coming to Kauai. So it was important just to get the information out. And, of course, we did a map showing the exact affected area, specifically at the North Shore, because the Keapana area is not a visitor area, and the Kaloa Town was a residential area as well. So from a rest of the island, from a tourism standpoint, was up and running pretty quickly after a few weeks. And, you know, of cleanup. And so it was just getting the messaging out. We did experience a short dip. I will tell you that the Pele and the eruption in Pohoa certainly changed things for us. I think the dip we would have experienced would have been much deeper had the volcano not erupted into the residential area over there, Leilani Estates. And so as a result of that, a lot of visitors were rebooked to Kauai and Maui. And that probably filled up any dip we might have had.
I was going to ask about that because I know the Big Island had a problem with trip cancellations and visitors rescheduling or canceling their trips altogether, even though it was
right.
A pretty small area of the island that
Correct.
Was affected, not dissimilar
right.
to what happened on your island. So how
exactly.
effective was that outreach effort that you undertook?
It was pretty effective. I have to say, you know, HBCB came in and helped us with HTA funding to get the word out. We did some, you know, social media posts of people that got on island. And even before they got here, we did a pretty big outreach to the newspapers, you know, a lot of the big boys to get the word out. And I think it helped showing the map was critical because just like for the island of Hawaii, right? Same thing where they thought the entire island was covered in lava and it wasn't. And so as a result of that, you know, really getting people, oh, I didn't know, okay, I'm staying in Poipu, okay, I'm okay. So that really helped a lot for people to get, you know, clear about, okay, the rest of my vacation is okay. I just won't be able to hike the Kalalau Trail.
What has the economic impact been to individual businesses or whole communities since the flood? Because I know while the rebuilding effort was going on in Hanalei, there was kind of a stop on a lot of visitor activity because the roads were closed. Short-term rental websites had kind of removed a lot of those listings in Hanalei and that area. So how did
right.
that play out?
So, yeah, so good point. Even the Wailua River had suffered. You know, there was a couple areas that, you know, when you have a flood like that and a lot of debris comes down, I don't know if you saw any of the pictures, but boy, there was so much trees knocked down and came down. And I don't know if you saw Lydgate Beach Park, but it was 100% full of wood from the interior trees. And it was shocking to see that picture. So Wailua River was shut down, I want to say. So all the kayak guys, everybody was shut down probably for almost a month. And so there was the economic impact of that. And there was certainly the economic impact of Hanalei Town who had benefited from people coming and going to the Kalalau Trail in KA and to the Hanalei Colony Resort. And so we had to get the word out that, you know, Hanalei Town was open for business. There were a couple properties, I should say restaurants, that were affected because they're right by the river. And so they certainly had a little bit of a cleanup to do. It was the Dolphin and Postcards and a couple other businesses there. And certainly, of course, the Taro Fields, the poor Haraguchis had, you know, suffered quite a bit of flooding for the taro fields as well. So the taro production was impacted as well. So yeah, there was definitely an economic impact. I don't have a number on that, but I know, you know, there's been kayak companies that launch out of KA and they had to shut down for the, you know, this whole entire year pretty much. And then also the vacation rentals that were in there also were not allowed to operate. And so that's it's definitely had an economic impact to those individual businesses for sure and to this day.
And has the continued closure of Ha'ina State Park and the Kalalau Trail, how has that impacted the economic situation? Because as you mentioned, that's a big draw for a lot of people, which brings them to the North Shore and to Hanalei Town. Right. Has there been a decrease in traffic to that side of the island?
Well, you know what happens is when you shut off one area, other areas get impacted. And so I will tell you that Waimea Canyon has seen a huge increase in visitors as a result of the Kalalau Trail being closed because there's hiking up in that area. So we've been getting calls from Koke'e's side about where did all these people come from. So certainly there was a reroute of what people could do. And yes, I think the people that have been impacted, and you know, it's been longer than we all expected, right? But you know, that was our messaging, was if you love Kauai, you'll stop by Hanalei Town and frequent the businesses and the restaurants and give them some business and give them the love. And I know even Chamber of Commerce, our Kauai Chamber of Commerce, had a business after hours event or said, hey, we're all going down and having lunch down there today, and rented a bus and everybody packed it in and went in there. So yeah, it's definitely been one of those unseen long-term impacts. And I think at this point, the reopening is going to be different than it was. So there's even going to be a different experience than, it's not going to go back to the way it was.
And so what will that new system be? Because I know the road's about to reopen, the park will reopen in the next month or two. How are things going to be different?
So what we realized is, if you look at it from a spiritual standpoint, it was almost that, you know, you guys can't take any more in this area. And the flood was really, you know, a lot of us took that as a message of, you know, this has got to stop and we can't continue as is. The Ha'ina Master Plan that was being worked on was, in fact, going to limit the amount of people in that area with or without the flood. But what the flood did is give the chance for everybody to be removed from the area and rebuild, you know, in a different way. And so I think that has, as tragic as it was, gave the state the opportunity to reboot. And now the new experience will be, it'll be a limit of 900 people a day. And it will be where you have to take a shuttle in after the parking is full. There'll be only 100 stalls, paid parking, and none of the overnight camping will be allowed to park in the parking lot. So you're going to have to take a shuttle in. So there'll be a fee for parking. There'll be still, of course, a fee to get into the park. There'll be a gate so that, you know, they're not going to just, you know, you have to show you have a permit to be in there. They will allow for cultural practitioners and subsistence fishermen. So there's, you know, some of those things that will continue that have been in the years and will continue on. They'll be allowed to continue doing what they've been doing.
And how could someone sign up for one of those permits?
So that's what we're working on right now, and to get the links for everybody. And that's why the park's not open. So one of the reasons why they're doing cleanup. And so when I have that, I will get that to you in a heartbeat. But Hanalei Initiative is handling the shuttle, and I can send you the link that gives you some more information for that.
Do we have an idea when the park will reopen?
So they're saying summer, early summer. So we're hoping for June, and I'm just not going to give out a date because things
sure.
have been changing by the day.
All right. Well, we will stay tuned and keep an eye out for that, Sue. Thanks for your time today.
Sure.
Sue Kanoho is the executive director of the Kauai Visitors Bureau. We'll have links to more information on that new system with the story at hawaiipublicradio.org. Honolulu Civil Beat's Chad Blair joins us live on the line from their Kaimuki studios to talk about the 11th hour wrangling over a water rights bill. Chad, there's like a week and a half left to go in the session. I can't believe it.
Maybe the 11:30 hour.
Okay, 11:30.
There is. This caught a lot of us by surprise, although there had been some scuttlebutt. I knew that the governor was in discussions with farmers, with the Sierra Club, with other parties involved. But what he did yesterday is he wrote a letter, Governor Ige, to the leadership of the House and Senate, copied it to all the lawmakers, and saying, look, let's take another look at that water bill, House Bill 1326. This is the one that's been in the news quite a lot. It's controversial. It has to do with diverting stream water. And it involves Alexander and Baldwin, Helco on the Big Island, KIUC on Kauai, some landowners, small farmers and ranchers. And in a nutshell, the bill as it currently stands would extend their water permits for another 7 years. The governor analyzed it, put Ford Fuchigami, his administrative director, on it, and he came to the conclusion that this is important. It's a fair and comprehensive bill. It would be a negative impact if for some reason this legislation were not to pass. So he basically said, let's keep this thing going, and that's where it is as of now. We'll see where it goes next, but that's where we are now, Catherine.
Right, but there was a whole flurry of press releases going, right, from the House to the Senate to the environmental.
Yeah, it's been really remarkable. I'll tell you what Scott Sikey, the House Speaker, said. He's like, he thinks that the governor did help answer some of the questions, some of the legal and practical questions are hanging out there, but Sikey made it very clear. This is up to the Senate. This is a House bill, but it already passed the House. It died in the Senate about 2 weeks ago. The Senate, President Ron Cochi, is saying, we'll continue working with the administration on the issue. He did not say, there will be a vote coming. If there is going to be a vote on this bill, it's going to have to happen by April 30th. That is the second to last day. Session ends May 2nd. That would be the very last time they could do something. So we'll see whether there is a development, but with this letter from the governor, he's in a sense he's really saying, I want this bill, I think it's important. He stopped short of saying he would sign it, but that was pretty clear his intention that he wants this to become law.
Yeah, but now the environmental groups are hopping mad,
not happy at all. Marty Townsend, the director of the Sierra Club, really been at the forefront of the opposition. In fact, they were successful in killing the bill so far. Marty Townsend really feels that the governor betrayed a trust. Remember that water is a public trust. She feels strongly that the governor overstepped his authority. This is an executive getting involved in the legislative branch. And by the way, it's also a judicial issue because that whole lawsuit that started this back in 2015, 2016, that lawsuit is still pending before the appellate court. So it's involving now all three branches of government. But yes, environmentalists are not happy. And we don't know what's going to happen next, but you can bet they're keeping an eye on developments.
You know, and I just checked my email before we went on the air here, and I just saw another press release from the Justice. Yes. And they were saying that the governor's legally mistaken and that he's got this alarmist position. So, a lot of people weighing in, lots of pressure now in this last week or so.
Yeah, it raises the question that even if a bill does pass, will it withstand a lawsuit? And that certainly seems to be something that could very well happen. Remember, there's already a lawsuit pending already. So.
Right. And I know the groups were concerned because they said, hey, you know, DLNR, the Ige administration was supposed to work out a system with these permits, and they didn't.
They were supposed to come up with long-term leases. I mean, right now it's these one-year revocable permits, but it's complicated. It has to do with getting environmental studies. It involves also the Water Commission. And the reality is, in the last 3 years since that bill was passed as a result of the lawsuit, they have not made much progress And by the way, environmental reviews cost money as well, and not everybody has quite the resources of A and B.
Right, and A and B had no comment, right?
No, they have had no comment. They've never formally testified on the bill. Sure seems like they'd want it to pass, but officially there is no comment. I'm guessing a lot behind closed doors, though.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks, Kathy.
That was Politics and Opinion Editor Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. Visit civilbeat.org for the full story and more. Earlier in the show, we asked you to name the plant root used to make Hawaiian moonshine, also called okolihau. Captain Nathaniel Portlock was one of the first to show Hawaiians how to make the intoxicating drink in the 1780s. Now, the consumption of okolihau skyrocketed a decade later when escaped Australian convict William Stevenson taught local moonshiners how to streamline the process. His process was to distill a mash of fermented tea leaf roots in the iron pots already in use by whalers to boil blubber. So in 1889, a bottle was smuggled into the World Exposition in Paris, where judges officially conferred the bronze medal to the government of Hawaii. In 1915, it took first prize for excellence at a spirits competition in San Francisco. Congratulations to Stephen and Angela from Holly Eva. Apparently he was driving, so she called in his answer. You got it right. And we had calls from all over Kauai, Maui, Big Island. Lots of moonshine stories. That is today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Island Insurance, and Sacred Hearts Academy.
Curiosity, innovation, and the future. We first met Professor Po Chiwu last November when he was in town lecturing at the Schuyler School of Business at the University of Hawaii. A visiting professor from UC Berkeley and adjunct professor at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, he returns to Honolulu this month to share his expertise. His upcoming lecture will explore how innovation drives change.
The particular twist in this is that I am now associated with an academic work for the last 10 years. When I was young, I was set on a path to become an academic, and I tried everything to get as far away from academia as I could. I think part of it was kind of a rebellion in the sense that my father was a world-class theoretical physicist. And one of the things that he's most famous for is that the first two Chinese to win a Nobel Prize in physics were his students. Not just students in his class or graduate students, but he discovered them when they were undergraduate students in mainland China. My parents were from mainland China. And when he noticed their talent, he helped bring them to the U.S., get their further education, and kind of was a lifelong mentor for them. So that was very impressive. But then, I guess a couple generations back, I have a great-great-grandfather, somebody who was one of the last so-called Hanlin scholars. And that was a significant accomplishment in those days.
Yeah, so, and here you are. You did not manage to avoid your fate.
Well, this is the whole point of fate, right? You do everything you can. You say, I'm going to do this. I'm going to plan. I'm going to prepare myself. I want to have different goals. And eventually fate just says, well, you know, there's this little thing that you didn't actually complete. And I have to say that it has been amazingly rewarding. I don't think I was completely amazed, and I don't regret the fact that I didn't take the more direct path, because the things I am able to do now as an educator are things I would never have been able to do if I had gone the academic route. And that's really important. And that was actually sort of the kernel of what I started thinking about. I didn't want to be, when I was a child, looking at my father, for example, as a theoretical physicist. You know, we talked about ivory tower science, you know, ivory tower scientists, and you're very removed from society. And I've always been enthralled by science and technology. I grew up in the age of the first rockets, and, you know, the first man on the moon was when I was in college. And technology, computers. When I was in high school, I was privileged to work on one of the earliest IBM so-called mainframes, the so-called 360, IBM 360. This is about, you know, the size of this room. So I've kind of grown up with all of this and always found it something that I always wanted to do. But I was interested in again, how it could affect people in society. Actually, having taken the more commercial route through venture capital and working with startup companies, I bring a very different dimension to what I can offer to the students, which is I don't lecture to them, right? This is very important. I focus on what they can learn. And speaking with David I, we're talking about some new programs we'd like to bring to the University of Hawaii. And to Hawaii is a whole state, and not just as an institution, but really to help our local population, and I mean both the local Hawaiian population as well as all the citizens of the state, to understand that you have a lot of resources and you have a lot of advantages here in Hawaii that are unique to the United States and to the world. And there's a tremendous opportunity really to inspire and help train young people, not only university, but even, you know, moving into like high school and middle school, to inspire these young people to really look at themselves differently. It's really all a matter of mindset and really the ability to express yourself in creative things or in innovative things is about your mindset. And you have to look at the world differently. You can't just look at the world and see it the way everybody else sees it. I mean, there's nothing new there by definition. But part of the problem with education is that it's very much tied to very conventional ways, to knowledge that has already been known. And what we teach in school is master this known knowledge, right? Solve problems we already know how to solve, and then we give you a diploma and we say you're good to go. That may have been true 30 or 40 years ago, but today that contract no longer applies. And so students need to learn how to solve new problems with new knowledge.
So let's talk about curiosity and innovation and the speed at which things are changing our lives.
So all of this, we call it an exponential rate of change, is in fact another reflection of the so-called Moore's Law of computers. The design of microprocessors, the integrated circuits that drive computers, the net effect of that in the so-called Moore's Law is that the power doubles every 18 months. And that by definition is an exponential rate of growth. And because we use computers in absolutely everything today, that's what's forcing the change. And so we have many more new tools, not just computers and smartphones, but every part of our lives are affected by this, mostly for the positive. But of course, there are also some new threats. Now, what's happening with the so-called millennial generation, and that's a particularly interesting area to focus on, many people think that, well, they're obsessed with their phones and their games and Facebook and so on, social media. And all of that is undoubtedly true. However, this generation is interacting, you know, among themselves in a very different way because they have these new tools. And they're used to thinking about the way these tools are designed. Their brains are literally being shaped by the way the software is designed. This is not necessarily a bad thing, but part of what is happening is that they are a little bit removed from sort of the problem side. Human society has always designed new tools in order to solve problems. That's why we do it. And here we have new kinds of technology. What makes sort of everyday problems less obvious, right? Everything is about convenience. One button this, one button that, instant gratification, instant visual kinds of connections. And it's all very good, but in many ways, it's reducing our capacity to feel curious because curiosity actually takes work. Curiosity is a natural phenomenon that the brain actually feeds on itself. It secretes a hormone called dopamine, which also happens to affect our pleasure center. So the more we exercise our curiosity, the more we feel pleasure in doing so, which is part of the inspiration for learning. And it's a wonderful thing, But if you gratify everything too quickly, then this doesn't kick in. You know, it's kind of like you short circuit it and you go right to the pleasure center and you miss all that cognitive activity.
So are we dumbing down?
In some ways we are, you know, and it's really quite frightening because it's like, you know, people will ask, you know, they don't even think about how things get done anymore. They just think, oh, well, there's an app for that. You know, let me look on my phone or let me look it up on Google, which is wonderful that we have these answers at our disposal through these kinds of search engines. But a bigger problem is, how do you know the information you're getting is now correct or accurate? And even Google searches, we know, have various biases. And friends, people I know talk about the internet as this giant garbage disposal, you know, mm-hmm. the dumpster.
A dump.
Because literally, lots of stuff is getting dumped out there, and a lot of it is unreliable. Some of it is intentional and misinformation and the fake news, whatever you want to call it. And it's increasingly difficult to sort out what is real. And this is a major, major challenge.
So what do we do? I mean, so the up-and-coming generation, they have a different operating system than maybe folks of our generation, but they're in the workplace. How do we go forward?
So one of the challenges in the workplace is that for middle-level managers who, of course, are a little bit older, they're hiring these new young people. These new young people know the technology better than their managers, and the managers say, well, you know, here's the task, go do this. And of course, they're going to use their own tools, and the manager says, I don't even know what you're doing. Now, that's a dilemma, because he cannot say, well, you have to do it using my old tools, because that would be inefficient, and they wouldn't know how to do that. And he can't argue with a success because they can do it. And so the traditional sense of boundaries and of power is really shifted. And this is the thing about technology. The technology drives change, and part of the change is a shift in power. Who has the power? Of course, it's people who have the knowledge, and the ability to use the new tools will have more knowledge. So what we need to do as the older generation is we have to both nurture and encourage young people, particularly their curiosity, remind them of the social context and the social contract we have between real people, remind them of the history that we have, whether it's a political history, how we understand our democratic process, which is a hot topic right now, or any of the issues, whether it's gender equality or racial equality or income disparities. What young people lack is what the one thing, I should put it the other way, and this is important for me as an educator. When I first was invited to teach about 10 years ago, I thought very hard about, okay, what can I actually offer to young students? They don't want to listen to lectures, and I don't want a lecture either because that would bore me, and I'm no longer a domain expert. So what can I offer? And I asked myself, what is the value of 25 or 30 years of work experience, right? If it's not just the knowledge anymore. So I said, okay, there must be something in this. I said, oh, it's context and perspective, because a young person who hasn't lived long enough can listen to me talk about something in a different country or a different time, but they still won't understand it until they live through it. So you don't get the context and perspective. And then you ask, okay, so what's good about that? The value in that is I know how to ask better questions. And that's really, really critical. And this is the point. Young people don't know the questions they should be asking. They're too used to looking for answers. Answers come easily today, search engine, or they ask friends. And the problem is, again, they don't know the right questions to ask. Therefore, they can't discriminate between what is real and reliable and something they can build on. And this is dangerous. And I think they have an instinctive reaction to that. They know this is kind of shaky.
So do you have a suggestion? Are there brain gym exercises they should do to increase their capacity for curiosity?
I think that the short answer is yes. But I think one of the more interesting ideas is actually for those of us who are on the other side of the millennial generation to remember that we, our brains, can also continue to grow and develop. And it is a process. So this is relatively new. You know, 30 years ago, we thought the brain was divided into different parts, and you know, left brain, right brain. But what we're learning today is the brain has amazing plasticity. That's the technical term for it, meaning different parts of the brain can actually take over functions that we thought were more relegated to certain regions. And we also realized that when I was a child, they used to say, well, you're losing 25,000 brain cells every day, right? And that may be true, but what I tell my students is, by the time you complete my course, my semester-long course, I promise you will have new brain cells because I'm forcing you to think in these new ways and you'll have new neural pathways and it'll create new brain cells. So we should have this giant national global program and say, hey, let's all try to increase our neural pathways. Let's have older generations, younger generations, let's get all kinds of people together to exercise curiosity in whatever way. You know, we have these things like science fairs for high school kids and even middle school kids. These are wonderful opportunities where adults can work with young people and children to learn along with them. And that's my philosophy of teaching as well, is that I have something to offer, but they have a lot to offer to me. And I need to learn something from them. I need to know what they're thinking about, what do they care about, how they want, they're looking at their futures, because we're all absolutely intertwined here. It's not like we can just do a handoff and, you know, say good luck.
So it's basically walking hand in hand going forward.
I love that image.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Wu.
Well, thank
you. It's been a pleasure having you.
That was Professor Po Chi Wu, described as an innovation provocateur. He returns for an April 25th lecture and April 27th workshop hosted by the University of Hawaii Outreach College. Check it out. Pick his brain. For information, to find out more, check our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
It's spring, a time of renewal and a time of hope. And we at Wait Wait just hope we do as well as we did when we convinced Candace Bergen to be on our show, not to mention William Shatner and Conan O'Brien. I'm Peter Sagal. We will look forward and backwards simultaneously on this week's Wait Wait Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday morning at 11, following Radiolab.
That's it for this week. Coming up on Monday, a call-in show to help you avoid problems when trying to upgrade to the Gold Star driver's license. The deadline is looming. We'd like to hear from you. Call or talk back line. Leave your comments. The program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Khan Grusby. The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday and pick up the conversation.